Members and guests to the October 11th meeting of the City Club of Eugene. Welcome KLCC listeners and our TV audiences on community television and the Oregon WIN network. I'm Mary Layton, City Club past president. Our sponsors today are John Brown, Evans Elder Brown, Essex General Construction, high quality construction at cost conscious prices, KLCC, NPR for Western and Central Oregon, and the recent beneficiary of a whole team of 8 City Club phone answerers, where we exceeded our goals for the 3 hours we were assigned to answer the phone. Thank you very much, KLCC listeners. And a special thank you to KLCC for airing our programs on Monday night. Many people who called in to pledge Thursday morning mentioned they were happy to hear City Club online. Thanks also to KPFF Consulting Engineers for our office space and the Oregon Community Credit Union for hosting this week's field trip for teachers studying the local economy and employment in the course sponsored by City Club of Eugene and Lane Workforce Partnership. You know I'm not going to let this opportunity pass to remind you that on October 20th from 5 to 8 at Cosmic, we're planning the City Club Follies. This is the first annual Follies, and we have an amazing trophy, kind of Emmy Award-style trophy for the winning song. We have at least 10 acts lined up, covering topics from gun control to biking to summertime in the Emerald City. The cast now includes the Raging Grannies, Lawrence Crumb, Shannon Coltrane, who's singing Guinevere in Camelot. Everybody's going to have to work hard to match that. She's going to do a song from Annie Get Your Gun about can't practice peace with a gun. The Three of Hearts sing in close harmony on the sadness of school accountability and tests that kids don't pass. Claude Offenbacher and many other local luminaries. We're grateful for the hospitality of Cosmic, which is offering the site and technical assistance as its in-kind contribution. We've collected raffle prizes from the Oregon Country Fair, and it's not what you're thinking. The Pantry and Pub, Sacred Earth Botanicals, and Perry Joseph, an award-winning local printmaker, has given us one of his prints to raffle off. Remember, it's Sunday, October 20th from 5 to 8 at Cosmic, and this is, I think of as a Chicago-style voting process. For your $5 donation and admission, you get 5 votes. You can buy more votes for more dollars, and the prize is given to the act which gets the most votes. We are a member club, a member-supported organization. If you're not already a member, please consider a tax-deductible virtual or regular City Club membership, sponsorship, or donation. Today's presenters are Allie Valkyrie, activist and community organizer, Pat Farr, Lane County Commissioner, and Professor Ofer Robin, University of Oregon School of Law, who will discuss when and where is sleep a legal right. The program for this Friday forum will explore homelessness as a civil rights issue. City and county authorities closed down a number of illegal campsites this summer. Campers, and they continue to do so, campers who were evicted from these areas, called environmentally sensitive, asked where they should go. They were given no options, but simply told to leave. During the same period, a municipal court judge ruled that the county had violated free speech rights of a group that was camping on Wayne Morse Free Speech Plaza. The tumult around this issue continues, and nobody will suggest that the problem of homelessness is simple or that it's going to be solved in one simple meeting or even two good works. We have to figure out how to solve it at root causes as well as in the short run, because if we waited to fix everything at the root cause, some gardens would never grow. Three speakers will talk about this idea from different angles. I think it's important to mention that two of the speakers who are famous for different positions on the subject, Allie Valkyrie and Pat Farr, if you compared their resumes at the same age, you would not have predicted which side of the issue they would fall on. These are not people, one of whom believes homelessness is fine and the other one who believes it's not. These are two people who have spent some time working on this issue. They are informed, they have committed their lives to fixing problems that arise from poverty, and they simply have different opinions on the best way to fix them. These two people will be joined by a professor of law who's going to talk to us a little bit about the constitutional issues. Professor Ofer Robin teaches constitutional law, criminal investigation, criminal law, and legal theory at the University of Oregon. He received his JD from Harvard, his doctor of philosophy and legal philosophy from Oxford, and worked as a prosecutor in New York before returning to academia. Allie, I discovered, is an artist by trade, an activist by opportunity. And she's been a community organizer for more than a decade. Her focus is on civil rights issues as they affect the poor and unhoused, especially laws and policies that criminalize homelessness. Pat Farr is an emigre from England. At the age of 10, he came here. He graduated from Tillamook High School, enrolled at the University of Oregon, where he met his wife. He's lived here for a long time, and he's served time as a Oregon House of Representatives. That could be hard. As a county commissioner for North Eugene, he served as the executive director for Food for Lane County, served in the Oregon Army National Guard, worked for the Oregon Food Bank, the Oregon Commission on Child Care, the Lane County Human Services Commission. He's been earning his stripes in the field of helping people afflicted by poverty, and I look forward to hearing what Pat and Allie have to say and offer. Oh, I realize we did not talk about order of business, so everybody should be up here. And as they said in Free to Be, when they were talking about who the tigers should eat first, it would be ladies first.
Should I just talk?
Yes.
Okay. Hi there. Thank you, first of all, to the City Club for inviting me. This is a really wonderful forum to be speaking in front of. My name is Ali Valkyrie. For the past probably 2.5 years, I've been pretty much fighting nonstop on behalf of the homeless in the city of Eugene. And as most people know here, the focus has pretty much been on sleep as a human right. First, I'd like to talk about what that doesn't mean, because there's been a whole lot of misunderstandings about what SLEEP is and what we're trying to do. SLEEP stands for Safe, Legally Entitled Emergency Places to Sleep. And that word entitled has been misused a lot. And, you know, by entitled, we're not standing here saying everyone deserves free housing. We're not saying that people are owed something necessarily. What we're simply saying is that the right to sleep is a fundamental human right that needs to be respected. And if there are no places for people to sleep, people still have to be allowed to sleep. And, you know, Eugene is a very unique city. You know, a lot of people, I mean, I hear it all the time. People say, why are there so many homeless people in Eugene? And to be honest, compared to other college towns, there aren't really that many more homeless people in Eugene than anywhere else. Eugene's homeless population is well above the national average. But when you take into consideration other mid-sized college towns, Boulder, Colorado, Ann Arbor, Michigan, Austin, Texas, just to be a few, the homeless population of Eugene really isn't that significant. What's significant about Eugene's homeless population is its visibility. And, you know, what we've been saying, you know, the downtown problem for the past 30 years is really a good example of that. And I have really come to the conclusion that Eugene doesn't necessarily have more homeless people than other places. You just see them more. And one of the main reasons you see them more is because Eugene does not have adequate shelter. And that's where the whole, you know, sleeps issue comes in. The camping ban in Eugene has been enacted since 1983. It's been 30 years now that for homeless people, sleeping on public land is completely against the law everywhere in both city limits, and also the county has a similar regulation on county limits. And that law was passed as a result of something called the Vagrancy Task Force of 1983. We're going back to the Reagan era, where all of a sudden mass homelessness became a brand new problem, and a coalition of Eugene citizens came together to try to solve this problem, and they came up with a few recommendations. Their main recommendation was to limit camping on public land, which had always been allowed. Their recommendation to deal with that consequence was to open public and private campgrounds throughout the city and the county. The city council in 1983 decided to enact the camping ban, but 30 years later, there still hasn't been any public or private places opened for people to sleep. And whereas in 1983, when the camping ban was passed, there was probably 400 to 500 homeless people in the city of Eugene, we are now in 2013, where the one-night count, which is considered an undercount, counted over 1,700 people last year. In addition, the Lane County Board of Education says there's nearly 2,500 people in Oregon schools who are homeless, 2,500 children. So the problem of homelessness here, you know, it's again, a widespread issue. But the main crux of the issue that the sleeps people have been battling with is the fact that there are less than 1,000 shelter beds in this entire city, and there are at least 1,700 people, probably many more, that have no legal place to sleep. And, you know, for the past 30 years, their existence has literally been criminalized. And, you know, I want to take this moment to say, you know, sleeps is not a criticism of what has been done or what hasn't yet been done. Everyone would love more housing. Everyone would love more shelter. Everyone wants to solve homelessness. And we keep looking at that long-term thing about how do we solve the homeless problem. For many of us who work among the homeless, it's kind of a realization that we're not going to solve that problem. It's not solvable. Homelessness is a consequence of capitalism. It's a consequence of the fact that there are never going to be enough jobs for everyone. And it's a consequence of real big holes in our social safety net regarding mental illness and drug addiction treatment. You know, we're never going to solve the problem. No matter how much housing we try to build, we're never going to be able to build enough with our current resources. And in the meantime, there's a group of people who literally live like refugees. They wander around every night and they have no place to sleep. And up until this summer, there were always certain places in Eugene where we allowed them to sleep and we sort of looked the other way. The West Eugene Wetlands has become the biggest example of that, where, as Mary mentioned, in last June it was evacuated and over 200 people, some who had been out there for years, were left with no place to be. These sweeps have also occurred on the riverbanks and on other places throughout the city. And so currently you have a homeless population that's more visible than it's ever been. Going back to sleeps for a second, you know, sleeps was in many ways the brainchild of Jean Stacy, who's sitting right in front of me. That was a big part of it also, though. And sleeps really came from the realization that, you know, we are in a terrible problem here where there aren't enough places to sleep. And when we talk about legally entitled, going back to that entitlement, the reason we say that people are entitled to the right to sleep is because specifically in the Ninth Circuit, federal courts have ruled that when there is no adequate shelter, arresting people and punishing them for sleeping is considered cruel and unusual punishment. And that decision rests on the fact that sleeping is not a choice. Most crimes we commit are a choice. If you steal, that's a choice. Even if you're drinking an open container, you chose to do that. But in criminalizing sleep when there's no other options, we're literally punishing people for doing something that every single creature on the planet has to do. And in 2007, in a case out of Los Angeles, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals found that this was unconstitutional. And both the city of Los Angeles, as well as other cities throughout the West Coast, have conformed their laws around sleeping and homelessness to reflect this fact. In the city of Los Angeles, people are allowed to sleep on the sidewalk at night. Same with Portland. In Seattle, there are many tent camps. Most places up and down the West Coast, they've done something to deal with the fact that it's unconstitutional to be punishing people for sleep. But in Eugene, we haven't done that. And so, you know, when the Sleeps campaign came out last December, the point we were trying to make to the city and the county and otherwise is you have this entire population of people who are mostly hidden who we're not going to be able to build housing for anytime soon. And you either need to just stop arresting them at night or, better off, you can designate a place where people can sleep. Last December, we went out on the Free Speech Plaza, a big protest to put this point forth, and the very next day, we were shut down by the county administrator who claimed health and safety violations. This issue, as well as the subsequent curfew closing that happened a month later, ended up a big court hearing in June, July. We spent a lot of time in court over this issue, and two subsequent decisions were issued a week apart, and those decisions basically stated that the county violated, actually specifically, my constitutional rights by closing the plaza a day after the protest started, because such closings, which I'm sure the professor next to me will explain better, there's something called a time, place, and manner restrictions, where any time you cut down First Amendment rights, you need to to follow four standards, and those standards weren't followed in my case. And we went out there again, of course, the day later after my case was, and both cases were settled. And 4 weeks later, the county evicted Sleeps again, again for health and safety regulations. At least they waited a month this time. And whereas, you know, I have my own criticisms around that, I'm only given 8 minutes, so I'm not going to go into that too much. But needless to say, Sleeps is still out there to today. And there are other groups called Whovilles which have branched off on Sleeps. And they're still camping on public land, mainly because they have nowhere to go. And they're probably going to continue to be out there until further notice. They've been cited by the city. The Whoville camp's been cited 3 times in the past 5 days. They've been threatened with arrest. They constantly have to move. But what you really have in Eugene right now is a modern-day refugee population. I don't really see any difference. And, you know, we can argue all we want about whether homelessness is a choice and whether they should get jobs or not. But at the end of the day, there's a huge population that literally is not allowed to sleep. And us out there are saying sleep is a human right. Please let them sleep. And I'll go to Pat.
Thanks, Allie. You'll find that many of the things that Allie spoke about, I'm firmly in her camp, so to speak. We agree on many of the issues that surround homelessness. I'll talk more about that. First, I'll mention that I am distinctly honored to be on this panel today. I have a wealth of experience myself. When I say wealth, I don't mean it's great. I mean a lot of it. That's what I bring to the panel, is my experience and what I believe and what people who I trust have, people who have earned my trust, who have helped me to believe. Sitting next to me, we have Allie, who believes many of the same things, and she carries an old message with a new voice and a new theatrical way of presenting it. And I appreciate listening to Allie and watching the way she delivers the old message, the message that I've been talking about for a very, very long time. And Professor Aban, I'm honored. I don't have a degree from Oxford or a degree from Harvard. I have a different set of experience, but between the three of us, we should be able to give you a good presentation regarding where we are in Eugene today and where we hope to be for the future. I'm very pleased to Pastor Dan asked me to be here, and initially it was scheduled for last week, and I thank you for being able to accommodate the change. Last week I was visiting Bud Clark Center in Portland, which is a homeless facility. It's a multi-story homeless facility downtown Eugene, and I went with a group of folks from Eugene and saw a very interesting facility, something that we're doing parts of here in Eugene, but we don't have the kind of money that they have in Portland to establish such a wonderful facility. We can talk more in detail about that at a different time and a different venue. There's a lot to be said about what Bud Clark is doing and what maybe we can begin to emulate here in Eugene, and things that they're doing that we certainly don't want to emulate here in Eugene. But I will say that today we're only going to scratch the surface of homelessness. We're only going to scratch the surface of the right to sleep, or the right to do anything for that matter. We have a very short period of time. We won't be talking very much at all. We'll have a few minutes. Allie said we have 8 minutes. That's roughly about what we have. And how much can you say in 8 minutes about what we've done, what we want to do, and what's been done that shouldn't have been done? So I'm going to say this at this point. On October 22nd, I will be having a town hall on this exact same subject. We will have more time to talk about it. It'll be at a time where it won't be in the middle of the day, where a different group of people perhaps can come, and the same group of people can come. The place will be the place is yet to be announced. I'm going to invite the two panelists who are here with me today to join me. If they're unable to join me, I will ask someone to replace them who has a similar background, similar experience, although certainly not at the peak of their background and experiences as my two colleagues are up here today. So we're here on the surface to discuss when and where is sleep a legitimate, when and where is sleep a legal right, I believe is the exact words. And the answer to that really is dynamic, based upon where you are and the community you're in and who made the last decision. Now, we can talk about the constitutionalism of it, and really the Constitution, I'm not an expert on it, and every generation debate surrounding the Constitution evolves a little bit. And I know that Professor Aban has a wealth of knowledge there, and I'm hoping to hear more from him regarding that. But really, it is dynamic, and whoever made the last decision quite often is the people or the body that determines where it is legal to sleep. Here in Eugene, we have a couple of different jurisdictions that have made decisions regarding where is it legal to sleep. Now, Ali mentioned back in 1983, the Vagrancy Task Force said it's illegal to camp in Eugene. Well, in 1997, we came back to challenge that pretty significantly when I was on the Eugene City Council the first time. And that we founded the Council Committee on Homelessness and Youth, which was originally to consider the subject of homeless youth in Eugene. We met for about 4 years. I was the chair of the committee. There was the mayor was on the committee at the time. Another city councilor, Bobby Lee, was on the committee. And the main staff people were in the back of the room right there. Richie Weinman, who was with the city at the time, and Pearl Wolf, who was at the time, was with the Looking Glass, I believe, who's now with the county. And did a lot of work regarding what is happening with homelessness. How can we have these arcane, archaic, ridiculous laws on the books, and why are people being forced to camp down on Washington Street and disrupt the neighborhood, as the neighbors described it. So we began to address some of the issues surrounding homelessness, and we did. We changed the camping laws in Eugene significantly. And to say there aren't legal places for people to camp in Eugene, that's not correct. We did change the law. You see camping in parking lots that is sanctioned, that have sanitary facilities. You see camping in backyards, which is sanctioned, that have sanitary facilities. And you see camping in church parking lots, etc. So does that solve the problem? Certainly not. It barely scratches the surface of solving the problem. But we did other things. We opened Station 7 for runaway youth, for instance, and a number of different venues that began during the Council Committee on Homelessness and Youth. I have 6 pages here, and I brought all 6. This is 6 pages of the history of efforts surrounding homelessness in Eugene. Of these 6 pages, 3 of the pages pertain to the Council Commission on Homeless and Youth and the laws that we changed back in 1997, 98, 99, 2000, and the ramifications of the laws that we changed. Do we still need to change laws? Absolutely we do. Will we change laws? Once again, it's dynamic. The laws will be changing. Do we need to change laws? You bet we do. Do people need a legal place to sleep? Yes, of course they do. Now, so will the current decisions be made by the Lane County Commission regarding the closure of the Wayne Morris Plaza for overnight stay? And will the decisions of the city be superseded? Of course they will. And will they be superseded by subsequent bodies? Yes, they will. Or by the courts? Yeah, they will. But we're here at this point in time right now, and the best thing that we can do is look at the conditions surrounding homelessness and begin to chip away and work with the people in this room, many people in this room, whose life it is to work on homeless issues, to provide places for homeless people to eventually call their regular, stable, permanent homes, and to help people to not slide into the conditions that surround homelessness. We all know that every single homeless person that you talk to has a very, very different story. Some people have mental illness. Some people are on the streets because of the deinstitutionalization of mental facilities. Some people are disabled. Some people are just out of a job. Some people prefer that lifestyle. Everybody has a different story. We found that during our debate on the Council Committee on Homelessness and Youth. We had round tables where people told us why they were homeless and why they were homeless in Eugene. We will continue that discussion. Now, I say that there are people in the audience here whose life it is by working with people who are suffering from poverty and homelessness. I see Susan Bann in the back, who is with Lane Shelter Care. Thank you for being here, Susan, and thank you for the tremendous work you do. Sitting next to her is Beverly Hughes, Food for Lane County. Beverly is the current executive director. I formerly was the executive director of Food for Lane County. Serves 7 million pounds of food a year. Thank you for the work that you do. I see Terry McDonald sitting very close up here, St. Vincent de Paul. And I see Pastor Dan saying 2 minutes to go. So, thank you, Dan. So there are others in the room. Richie Wyman's back there. Phil Wolf's back there. Steve Manella sitting back there. Peggy Whalen is sitting back there. We have a room full of people whose life it is to serve the people in this community who are in danger or who are at risk. Now, my goal my stated goal, and I say it over and over again, is as long as there's a 7-year-old who misses a meal, we're not doing our job. And I'm not meeting my goal. Because in this community, we have lots of hungry people, as we have lots of homeless people. We need to work with the folks who are already providing the services to provide a broader range of services, to fund a broader range of services, and to really get deep into this issue so we don't have to, so people, less and less people all the time, have to worry about where do I sleep tonight, because they have a more stable place to sleep. That's what we need to focus, and that's what we'll talk about more from this point forward and for all of the years that I continue in public service.
My name is Ofer Aban, and I teach constitutional law at U of O, and I'm here to provide some background on the constitutional issues involved, specifically the federal constitutional issues that I'm involved in this debate. So first, as a preliminary matter, the federal constitution recognizes no obligation on the part of the government, be it the federal government or the state or the city, to provide for shelter for the homeless or even to designate certain land specifically for the homeless to sleep in. That the operative principle here is that the federal constitution imposes no affirmative duties on the government. The federal constitution is, in principle, a protection against government powers. But again, it does not impose any affirmative duties on the government to provide anything whatsoever. There are no social or economic rights under the federal constitution, no obligation to provide shelter, no obligation to provide education, not even obligation to provide food. Now, by the way, this is not the case with all constitutions. There are many constitutions around the world that do provide for social and economic rights. In fact, there are about a dozen states that provide for social and economic rights in their constitution. New York, for example, imposes an obligation on the through its constitution, imposes an obligation on the government to care for the poor. New Jersey residents have a constitutional right for some form of public education, etc. But again, this is not the case under the federal constitution, and even Roosevelt's second Bill of Rights, that his famous call for some social and economic rights that was given in his 1944 State of the Union address, even that call pertained to statutory rights and not to constitutional rights under the federal constitution. Now, there are various reasons as to why the federal constitution does not provide for any social and economic rights. We can discuss those during the questions and answer period. But the short of the matter is that Eugene has no obligation under the federal constitution to provide for some form of shelter. Now, it is, as was noted earlier, it is a different matter altogether as to whether Eugene can penalize homelessness. So the city can certainly forbid homeless individuals from sleeping in certain places and at certain times, but it cannot forbid homeless individuals from sleeping in all places at all times. A number of courts held that if such bans are actually enforced, again, it is not enough that you have such ban on your books. If it is shown that such bans, citywide bans, are actually enforced at all times and at all places, that would be a violation of the Eighth Amendment prohibition on cruel and unusual punishment. And again, the idea is simple. If a person has no money for shelter, there is nothing that that person can immediately do but to sleep at some public place and therefore to violate the law. Courts refer to such violations as involuntary violations of the criminal law. And again, this was declared by a number of courts, including the Ninth Circuit, in a decision that was mentioned as a violation of the Eighth Amendment to the United States Constitution. But again, there is a very high demand of showing for such finding of constitutional violations. The plaintiffs must show first that there are no beds in any shelter that are available, but also that the city, in fact, enforces this prohibition at all places and at all times, so that the plaintiffs have no choice, if you will, but to violate the law. 2 years ago, by the way, such a claim was dismissed against the city of Portland, that has also a citywide ban on sleeping and camping, because there was such insufficient showing. The consequences, by the way, of finding such a constitutional violation are rather modest. That is, there is a dismissal of criminal citations given to homeless individuals under such circumstances, and some courts may issue injunctions that forbid the city from enforcing its ban on public sleeping at certain times and at certain places. Okay, now let's move to the discussion of the constitutional provision that was actually involved in the litigation in the case, and that is not the Eighth Amendment, but the First Amendment. So in August, a municipal court dismissed charges against 21 protesters for violating the closure of the Wayne Morse Plaza between the hours of 11 p.m. and 6 a.m. The court held that enforcing this closure against these protesters was a violation of these individuals' free speech rights, that this was a violation of the First Amendment to the United States Constitution. Now, First Amendment doctrine recognizes that cities and governments in general may constitutionally regulate the time, place, and manner of expression, including of protests. Such regulations are, again, in principle, constitutional. Regulations of the time, the place, and the manner of protests are constitutional if, first, they are not aimed at suppressing expression. That is, the government may not suppress a certain message under the pretext that all it does is regulate the time, the place, and the manner of the expression. Second, such regulations must leave open alternative means of communications for this expression. So again, to be constitutional, the regulation that a regulation of time, place, or manner of protests must leave open alternative means of conveying that message. And third, that regulation must further a significant state interest. Now, the court order in this case was short and did not really contain any detailed constitutional analysis, but the court did not find that the closure was aimed at suppressing the message. It did not find that the closure of the Wayne Morse Plaza was in fact aimed at silencing these protesters. And obviously, the court did not find that there were no other open alternative channels of expression for the protests, if only because these protesters could continue their protests between the hours of 6 a.m. and 11 p.m. The court apparently determined that there was no significant government interest involved. Now, let me just say, as an aside, that this is a highly unusual determination. The city claimed that the cleanliness of the plaza and keeping the plaza in an aesthetically pleasing and orderly state was the reason for the closure. And there was indeed some minor evidence of minor vandalism and soiling of the plaza. But the United States Supreme Court repeatedly upheld the constitutionality of time, place, and manner regulations that were based on, again, similar reasons, trying to protect the aesthetic attractiveness or what have you of a certain location. Such regulations regularly pass muster in federal courts and under the decisions, precedents of the United States Supreme Court. Let me just mention one more case from last year. The Oregon Court of Appeals decision upheld Portland's closure of the Capitol steps between the hours of 11 p.m. and 7 a.m. for essentially similar reasons. And the court did so under the Oregon Constitution that, in fact, in principle, provides more free speech protections than the federal Constitution does. I will stop here. Thank you.
Wow. So now, having established amazing credentials among the panelists, I'm expecting the tables to come up with some amazing questions. So take a few minutes and develop them at your table.
You're tuned to KLCC Eugene 89.7 FM, KLCO Newport 90.5, 89.1 KLFR Reedsport, and at 88.1 KLFO Florence, KMPQ Roseburg, and KLBR Bend. We're also on the web at klcc.org.
Now it's time for questions from our members on issues around solutions to homelessness.
Jerry Smith, City Club member. What has happened to our moral principles that We don't allow people to abandon domestic animals that we release prisoners when jail cells are overcrowded, and yet we've dropped the kind of welfare that used to house all Americans who were without income.
I'll start that one. It's because we've dehumanized this population. I think we justify not doing anything by pointing blame at them. I hear all the time, well, they chose it. They're homeless by choice. And even if people don't go right there, they still like to say, well, there must have been something they did. I mean, look, they're drug addicted. That's something they did. And I think that we tend to all come from a place of privilege, and especially when one hasn't experienced poverty, it's really easy to blame someone for their lot in life. We take care of abandoned animals because it's not their fault. They're innocent. We don't look at the population like that. And this is, you know, something that we've been really doing historically. You know, if you read the newspaper from the 1930s, we called them Okies back then, but it was the exact same dehumanization to a population that we blame for their circumstance. And I think that the only way through that is really just to start seeing homeless people as people. You know, Whoville had a good little phrase that said, but for the grace of God goes Youville. And I think that that's very important to realize, that no matter how well off we may be, we're all, in a sense, one tragedy away from homelessness. And as soon as we stop seeing them as the other, I think that we'll start to, you know, what I say is, if the South Hills burned down tomorrow and 3,000 people ended up homeless, we'd do something immediately. And it's only because we blame this population for their own problems that the same action is not taken.
Thank you, Ali, and thank you, Mr. Smith. Mr. Smith has some very good points, and the way I would address him is a slightly different angle. We have more people who have fallen into homelessness today than we have historically, and the reasons abound for people falling into homelessness. We know that mental institutions have been closed, and that a lot of folks are on the street because they've been deinstitutionalized, and they have no safety net. Well, for those folks, we do have a kind of safety net that exists. That is a strong one, and that's through shelter care. There are a couple of programs that operate in Springfield. One is the Safe Haven, and one is the Inside Place. Both are designed for chronically homeless people with mental issues who qualify, who actually enter their program. Now, it's not a huge program, but it could be repeated in other places. And it runs almost on a shoestring. I mean, the amount of money that's actually spent on this to bring people off the street to sleep during the day, many of these people have to go back to the street at night. But significantly, there is a residential program associated with it. And the Inside Place for folks who, I will say, mentally ill, who are chronically homeless, the Inside Place has an 86% success rate of moving people from the street into permanent stable housing. So we do have people who are working on the issue. As the government decided to deinstitutionalize, as different things happened that caused more people to be homeless, the burden was shifted to private nonprofits and to private individuals, and we do have such programs in place. I just mentioned the one that is specifically for folks with mental illness, but there are other programs around town. Do we have enough? Certainly not. We need to work on them. I want to thank Mr. Smith for bringing the points forward, and it's one that we need to continue working on, because people are homeless for different reasons. More kids are homeless now because their mom's boyfriend raped them. You know, kids are homeless because their parents are third-generation drug addicts. We didn't have that when I was a kid. You know, we have different things causing kids to be homeless and have ever caused kids to be homeless before. So we have to address those things at the core, at the root. And it's been said that a garden doesn't grow by tending the roots, I think is kind of the paraphrasing of that. But we have to address the conditions, but we also have to address the roots. We have to get to the source of the homeless condition.
I'm Darnell Mandelblatt. I am a City Club member. I'm asking this question for a whole table full of guests because it's City Club members who can ask questions. The question is for Commissioner Farr. Where do you suggest people camp if they have no place to sleep that night? That is, if they're not assigned to the kinds of places that were discussed 20 minutes ago, where should someone go tonight to sleep?
That, you know, there are a lot of places that people can go, and I'm not going to say that I have a suggestion for every single person. So right now I have no suggestion where people can go to sleep if they've been turned out from the places there are. But as the professor has stated, the city does not universally, say, enforce the no camping ordinance throughout the entire city. So people are finding places to sleep, insufficient as these places may be. When the Council Committee on Homelessness and Youth made recommendations to the City Council, some of the laws that passed allowed for more camping in driveways, more camping in parking lots, and that program needs to be expanded so we actually do have more offerings for people to go and safely and legally sleep.
Hi, Kerry Thompson, City Club member. I was wondering whether it'd be legal to close camping on the plaza for all 24 hours, like what could they have tents there during the day, and also is it legal anywhere on county land to sleep outside?
This is a question really for the professor, but I'm going to offer one quick thing, and that is to say that in witnessing the camping that was taking place on the plaza, the campers there were actually restricting who could use the plaza when they were there. So if camping is allowed in any one place, if the people who get there first say, no, you can't be here, or we have established rules so that you can't be here, then rules are being established that really are outside of the commonly applied and commonly passed laws of the community. For instance, I visited the plaza when the folks were camping there day and night, and one day there was a woman in the plaza and she was actually kicked out of the plaza and told to go across the street. Now, I will say the plaza was clean, and daily people were keeping the plaza clean, but across the street, on the other side of Oak Street, it wasn't clean, and it wasn't organized, and it wasn't orderly. She was kicked out of the plaza and told to go over there. Well, I went over there, and pretty soon a tent got trashed, and she fell down, and she was kicked out of there also. So the bottom line of that is somebody's going to get kicked out, whoever is establishing the rules, and we need to make certain that we are addressing, once again, back to addressing things at the root. And it's a little bit disconcerting to me that the folks who were claiming the right to occupy the plaza were kicking people out of the plaza on their own right.
So again, as a statutory matter, many cities have laws that forbid sleeping and camping citywide. So this is not unusual at all. The constitutional question is whether these laws that again forbid sleeping / camping throughout all public land, all municipal land, whether these are enforced in a way that harasses homeless individuals. So the question is really one of enforcement insofar as the Constitution is concerned. A city may very well maintain the law on its book that again forbids sleeping throughout the city, insofar as it doesn't enforce it in principle at all times in all places in a way that makes it, again, in principle, not an option for a homeless individual but to violate the law.
My name is Michael Kerrigan. I'm a new City Club member as of today. Since there are a number of people from the business community in this audience, can you please speak to specific services and assets they and their businesses can provide to help alleviate the conditions of homelessness and sleeplessness in Eugene?
I can address that based upon my observation and my actual participation. There are a number of things that businesses do. Once again, a lot of businesses around town have opened up their parking lots for one or two or sometimes three camping households. They are doing that. Now, in my years of work with Food for Lane County, businesses provide a great deal of support to the existing services that we have inside of the community. Shelter care gets a lot of support from businesses. Food for Lane County does. I know that Women's Space does, and others get a lot of direct financial help from businesses. Now, that being said, a lot of the business owners, and I can't speak for every one of them, believe that their financial help is their contribution to alleviating the problem. Other people feel that providing their parking lots their answer to alleviating the problem. Others donate goods and services, others donate in-kind services.
I think the best thing that the business community can do is to overall support an atmosphere that does not criminalize. When I go downtown, to me the two biggest issues are issues that to everybody, no benches and nowhere to go to the bathroom. And these two issues are both because of the homeless community. You know, we took the benches away, thinking if we took the benches away, all the people would disappear. And we took the bathrooms away when we closed the downtown mall. And the main reason I hear that we don't want to install bathrooms is because we don't want them vandalized by homeless folks. However, everybody needs to sit, and everybody needs to go to the bathroom. And not having these two things really causes a backlash among the community. I hear businesses constantly going on about people sitting in front of our building and asking to use our bathroom. And the swarms of people you find on corners such as Broadway and Olive, for example, I think that if they had somewhere to sit, somewhere to be, somewhere to go, this would not be an issue. You know, public sanitation benefits everyone. By not having benches downtown, the businesses are kicking themselves in the foot because it keeps parents from with children from going downtown. It keeps the elderly from coming downtown. Not having bathrooms keeps people with medical issues from coming downtown. So, you know, we end up driving away a large percentage of the population because of our fear of one segment of the population. And I would also say to businesses that, you know, certain criminalization policies, such as the no trespassing signs all over town, which allow police to arrest people whenever they want to for being there, these are also, you know, these policies cause a backlash amongst the community. You know, if you treat people like animals, how do you expect them to act? If we don't treat people with respect and dignity, they're not going to treat you back with respect. All I hear downtown from the businesses is, these homeless people don't respect us. And all I can say is, yeah, you don't respect them either. It doesn't mean I condone their behavior, but I refuse to condemn it because respect is a two-way street. And once we start treating everyone like human beings who have the right to sit and go to the bathroom, I think it'll be a much more livable community.
Hello, I'm Diane Conrad, City Club member. My table reached consensus on a federal level question. The United Nations has a declaration of human needs, of human rights, and part of that was included the right to shelter. And the United States government is a co-signature to that policy. We're wondering at this point in time, how is the U.S. government standing up to that commitment?
Well, this raises a complicated legal issue of the relationship between treaties and conventions that the United States is signatory to and their enforcement within the United States. The general principle is that these are not self-executing treaties. That is to say, you cannot go to a federal court and try to enforce the terms of a treaty that the United States is privy to, unless, of course, there is some kind of legislation that actually enacts that treaty or convention as American federal law or what have you. So the fact that we are signatory to these treaties do not make them enforceable. Let me just add one more comment in this regard. Many of the countries that have social and economic rights in their constitutions, in fact, see those as inspirational rights. They are not rights that courts can enforce. And this is one of the biggest distinctions between the United States Constitution and many other constitutions, and perhaps one of the explanations as to why social and economic rights never made their way into the federal constitution, because we see the constitution as fully enforceable by a judiciary. And again, many of these social and economic rights are not enforceable by a judiciary, and you can clearly see why. These are, for the most part, unelected officials. And if they could enforce social and economic rights, they would, in fact, make budgetary decisions that we think are better made by representatives elected in regular elections. So again, even those countries that do have such rights oftentimes see them as inspirational guidelines and not something that a judge can actually order the government to do.
John Brown, City Club member. Question for the professor, please. What is your opinion regarding the State versus Babson case pending before the Oregon Supreme Court? What implications to the time, place, and manner restrictions would a decision to overturn the appellate court decision have?
You'll have to tell me about the decision. What was it again?
It's a decision of the State versus Babson. It came from our table, and I'm going to have the table talk about it's pending before the State Supreme Court from the appellate decision.
The Salem Capital Steps case.
Oh, you're talking about the Court of Appeals decision that is being appealed.
That's correct.
What is my again?
What implications to the time, place, and manner restrictions would a decision to overturn the appellate court case have on this it's been stated it would have far-reaching implications.
So the decision of the Oregon Court of Appeals was based on the Oregon Constitution, not on the federal Constitution. In fact, it is a staple of Oregon courts that they begin such constitutional challenges first by determining whether the Oregon Constitution was violated, and only then moving to the federal one, for the most part because in the area of the First Amendment of free speech, the Oregon Constitution provides more protections than the federal Constitution. Now again, the determination of the Court of Appeals was made based on the Oregon Constitution, and the court in fact refused to render any opinion about the standing of this challenge in regards to the federal Constitution, saying we need to resolve the Oregon question first. Time, place, and manner doctrine that I discussed is part of the federal Constitution. And as I said, in case after case in the United States Supreme Court and in other federal courts as well, the reasons that Eugene brought in order to justify the closure of the Wayne Morse Plaza were accepted as perfectly sufficient to justify the constitutionality of such regulations under the federal Constitution. The case that you raised again is under the Oregon Constitution that employs somewhat different analysis.
Thank you.
Bob Cassidy, City Club member. I'd like to get out of the courts and into money. Nearly every solution that comes about in helping with this cause, whether it's preventative for homelessness or actually dealing with some of the problems that are caused by that, involves raising money. And we hit the limits very quickly on that in many directions. What effort is there on the part of groups or individuals or anything to find a source of money that is acceptable? Some years ago, 10 years ago, the city tried Kitty's program for homelessness, was going to try and raise a basic $5 million or something like that to get started on this. That didn't go anyplace. If it's a basic right, say, to have a place to go to the bathroom, what is there a way to, you know, we can't deal with real estate money, how do we go about deciding how to raise money to solve the problems that we all want to solve, other than the volunteerism that we're doing now, whether it's volunteer businesses or volunteer handing someone something when they're standing on the corner with a cardboard sign? How do we go about saying, where's the money?
I'll start then, Pat.
Okay.
I think it's really a matter of reappropriating current resources as opposed to raising more money. The criminalization of homelessness costs this city a small fortune, and it's the kind of money that, frankly, your city government doesn't really want you to know about. Mayor Piercy speaks of a woman called Million Dollar Mona. I can tell you that Million Dollar Mona isn't the only one. There's about a dozen frequent flyers in this town who cost the city upwards of several hundred thousand dollars to deal with. Our municipal court alone is a $4 million a year hole in our funds. Boulder, Colorado recently renovated an old prison and turned it into a homeless shelter, and they found that they were formerly spending $75,000 a year per homeless person, and by sheltering them instead of criminalizing them, they got that down to about $25,000. Just by example, you know, only in the past week alone, 36 prohibited camping tickets have been written at just the Broadway and Hilliard location. If those folks choose to take those to trial, each citation will cost the city at least $1,000 in terms of court time, lawyer time, bureaucratic. So that's $36,000 that the city is going to spend criminalizing people for sleeping. If we reappropriated that $36,000 alone, that would not be enough to spend on porta potties for small camps all over the city to give people a place to legally sleep. Criminalizing the problem costs us a fortune.
Thanks, Ellie, and some good points you make there. I'll address it from a slightly different angle. In Lane County, we have a Human Services Commission, and Steve Manella sitting in the back of the room is the chief staff person for the Human Services Commission. Pearl Wolf sitting beside him works there also. The city of Springfield and Eugene and Lane County give money to the Human Services Commission to actually be the clearinghouse for how the money is distributed among the service providers in the county. That is the most efficient way to spend the money. And that's how we spend the small amount of money that we do have. Now, that also being the case, we identify places that we're not spending enough money, that we don't have enough enough money to provide housing, for instance. So in 1995, the city had Cracking the Housing Crisis, which is titled A Blueprint for Housing and Action Responses. Subsequent to that, we had the Council Commission Committee on to Finance Affordable Housing. I was on that committee, and we identified a source. It would have been a utility fee to provide 100 new units of housing per year. It failed pretty miserably at the ballot box. So finding the money and getting people to agree that where the money is going to come from, that is the balance that we as elected officials have to put forward. And significantly, the folks who are sitting in the room who are with 501c3s know all about raising money, because that's a lot of what they do. The money comes from private sources as well as government granting and government sources. So significantly, we try to get people to agree where we need to spend more money on particular human services. People don't always agree on that. The other thing that we have in the county is a really serious problem with our general fund. The reason we have a problem with the general fund is because we are an Oregon and California Railroad county, and we don't have timber receipts that we used to have. We cannot spend money that we don't have, and we have about someplace in the neighborhood of 70% fewer timber receipts, which allow us to less discretionary money to spend on human services and on parks and on public safety and other things. So it's a multifaceted problem that we have, and one that if we're going to address it, we have to address it with a multifaceted response.
Bob Hart, City Club member since 2012. Our table also was addressing the question of resources and their inadequacies. So our question is, how do we broaden the tax base, not for necessarily a government solution to this, but to basically fund the private organizations, the 501c3s, that are more efficient, and help them to do what they can only do inadequately at the moment because they don't have the resources. So it's a resource question. And for both of our speakers, other than our constitutional lawyer.
Personally, I'm in favor of, you know, what I call like luxury taxes that don't necessarily affect the low-income folks. Ashland, Oregon, for example, has a 5% restaurant tax that brings in between $2 and $3 million worth of revenue a year for the city of Ashland. That I believe, don't quote me, I believe they use on social services. When they passed that tax, the restaurant owners threw a fit. Absolutely not. People will not eat in our restaurants if they have to pay 5% tax, and all I can say is every time I'm in Ashland, I'm waiting for a table. I would also love to see an additional, you know, the county already has a transient room tax on hotel rooms, but I'd love to see an additional tax that specifically hits higher level hotel rooms, like the kind that our University of Oregon Ducks fans rent. I think that they take a whole lot of our money from city services and maybe should be putting some of it back.
Thank you. A slightly different direction. Once again, having worked with Food for Lane County, I used to say, put 6 pounds of food on the table for every dollar that would raise locally. Now Beverly says, I believe it's 3 meals for every dollar that's raised locally. Clearly, that is an efficient way to spend money. And clearly, the 501c3s have it down to a fine art how to spend the money, the best way they can spend the money. For my dollar. I like giving money to Food for Lane County and others who are spending it very, very efficient locally. I'd rather not give it to the government. I'd rather give it directly to the service providers who are not skimming off the top. They're just putting the money directly to the bottom line. I could talk on for hours about the good of the local service providers.
Okay. Merlin Huff, City Club member. Our question has to do with sleeping on sidewalks for any or all of the speakers. We had a good discussion about how some communities have decriminalized sleeping on sidewalks. Would this be a useful part of the solution here?
That's the solution we don't want. Portland and LA have both decriminalized sleeping on sidewalks, both as a result of court settlements over the same Ninth Circuit decision that I was referencing before. We don't think that's the right answer. You spent 40 years revitalizing downtown, having a federal judge say people can sleep on the sidewalks between 9 p.m. and 7 a.m. I do not see helping the downtown core. One of the reasons that we would love designated places to sleep is that this does not end up in federal court, and we do not end up with that kind of decision. I'd rather the community choose what happens than a federal court decide for us. So no, I would support such a, you know, decriminalization outside of the downtown, perhaps in the outer city limits, but I don't think sleeping on sidewalks is the answer.
And we have, here in Eugene, we have Opportunity Village, which is an experiment in West Eugene right now, and other ways to prevent sleeping on sidewalks. Once again, I was in Portland last week, and sleeping on sidewalks in the day is fine. People have to move along at night. So it's an interesting exact opposite they have there. Once again, we haven't really scratched the surface. October 22nd, we'll be having a town hall, and we'll have lots more time to talk about all of these subjects. You can grill me, you can drill me, you can nail me.
Thank you, Pat Farr, Valley Alkuri, and Ofer Raban, for bringing clarity and vision to this discussion of where and when is sleep a legal right. Next week, we will meet on October 18th for an evening program at LCC's downtown campus, Making Great Cities, Design and Democracy, beginning at 5:30 p.m. and ending with a light reception to follow. If you plan to attend, you have to RSVP to October 18 at dxoregon.org, D as in dog, X, Oregon.org. This program is a grassroots, volunteer-led effort by AIASWO, that's American Institute of Architects, Southwest Oregon Design Excellence Committee, working in partnership with City Club, the University of Oregon AAA Fall Lecture Program. We are grateful to the sponsors of this special program, Lane Transit District, the University of Oregon, local community members, and local community groups. Thank you again for bringing clarity and vision to this conversation. It was really a great panel.
Good job.